It's All Things Considered from North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Time again to review the week in politics. Here for the conversation are Becky Gray from the conservative John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield with the progressive NC Policy Watch. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Becky, Jeff.
Two more American mass shootings, El Paso and Dayton. Last Saturday, 22 lives were ended in West Texas. Hours later in Ohio, 9 people terminated in just 32 seconds. Meanwhile, the city of Chicago saw its deadliest weekend of gun violence this year, 7 dead. According to police, 32 separate shooting incidents took place in less than 48 hours. Mass shootings are a routine event in our country, making us unique in the world. Gun violence is widespread. An overwhelming number of Americans do support universal background checks, about 90% based on several surveys taken in recent years. Universal background checks will not solve this problem, but they might help. Instead of any policy action, plenty of finger pointing in recent days, pivoting to mental illness. Becky, there's the NRA, there are constituents. Conservatives do hold the power, both in the state and in the U.S. Senate. Who or what are they afraid of?
Well, I mean, I think that's a good question. I mean, I think one thing that, and I don't know what they're afraid of, but speculating on some of the forces that we see going on with this is a balance between government control and protection of constitutional rights, and specifically the Second Amendment constitutional right. I think that's kind of where I don't know that it's a fear as much as it is a caution, in my view, inaction on something that is very necessary to take place.
Are you among those 90%, roughly 90% of people that would support universal background
Absolutely.
Checks?
I am also among those people that think there's not one, and not to make a very poor pun here, I mean, there's not one answer, not one silver bullet, if
no,
you will.
There,
you know, to
not.
This, I mean, you mentioned, you know, mental health, personal responsibility. You know, there's a lot of things that need to be, and I think this is a complex problem. I think all of us, whether it's fearful or whether it's determination, want this to end. I mean, I think I haven't seen polling numbers on that. I cannot imagine that would not be, you know, universally accepted among people. How we get there, I'm not sure exactly what the answer is.
But to hammer down on it, why? Like, what is it? Is it the NRA? Because we hear a lot about them. Is it constituents? What is it that's really hanging this thing up at this point? I got on a plane 2 days ago. Think about all the steps you have to go through to get on a plane. Gonna have to re-register my car next month. Think about all the steps you have to go to just to have a car in this world. We're talking about a gun. And we're talking about, again, just to go back to this question. I'm not trying to break out into some big, huge debate over this. 90% of people support background checks.
Universal background checks.
Why is it so hard to get there?
Maybe this will be the day that we do
but
that.
We
maybe
keep
we'll
saying
be,
that
you know,
every time. Like, but what?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, Jeff. I mean, I wish I did. I am one of those people that thinks, yes, that is a very good idea. There's other good ideas that have to do with responsibility of owning a gun. You know, as you mentioned, getting your car registered. There's also a tremendous responsibility for operating a motor vehicle on the roads. You know, safety considerations. You can't drive while you're drunk. You know, there's all kinds of things like that. I think putting some restrictions on or responsibility and accountability on the use of a firearm is a sensible thing. I think we also need to look at the laws that we have in place and take a look at that and see where those are, where the loopholes might be. What exactly do we need to do? I think some hesitation, if you will, is if you're going to move forward with this and if you're going to start to look at putting some restrictions on a constitutional right, you want to make sure that you do it right and that you are not taking rights away from law-abiding citizens unintentionally.
Agreed. And Rob, I'm coming to you in a second. But we're not even having a conversation, right? We're not having a real meaty policy conversation. There is plenty of fighting and rhetoric that's taking place. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what you just mentioned, and I think that's an important functional thing. If we're going to alter the Second Amendment. You know, one of these provisions that's been around for 200 plus years. We've got to have a conversation about how to do it or how not to do it. But we're not really even having.
One of the impediments to having a really meaningful conversation and a really productive conversation goes to what you just mentioned, and it's with the accusations and the finger pointing and the accusations of morality on either side with this. I'm not sure how you have a productive conversation if you just stand and yell at each other.
I don't know if I've ever made you sit there that patiently for that long. So go ahead.
So much to say. America has a unique crisis, and you mentioned that at the outset, that this doesn't happen anywhere else. And they have mental health problems in every other country in the world that are just as severe, if not more severe, than occur in the United States. This is almost exclusively a function of our criminal negligence when it comes to regulating firearms. It's not true that the Second Amendment is always guaranteed a right to bear any arm you want. That's a recent claim by some folks on the right. Clarence Thomas is now trying to extend it even further. This is a function of the extreme right in America controlling the Republican Party and preventing them from considering common sense, middle-of-the-road legislation that should have been on the books for decades. We've had responsible, modest, minimalist bills introduced in the General Assembly 6 months ago. They haven't even been taken up in a committee in the legislature. The same thing's going on in Congress. It's a disastrous crisis. And here's the other reality. Our world is getting more complicated, more crowded, more populated. We have mass migration. We have the climate crisis. It's not going to get any easier to live with each other in the years ahead. We have got to do something to get a handle on the gun crisis in this country, or this won't become just a monthly occurrence. It'll become a weekly or even daily occurrence, and we will literally turn this country into a perpetual war zone, especially when we've got a president of the United States who is abetting white nationalism, who is effectively fueling the fire by complaining about immigrants and enabling and de facto encouraging people like the mass murderer in El Paso. So we got a lot of work to do, and it's going to take courage, and it's going to take some people, hopefully, in the Republican Party with some backbone to stand up to the NRA and to the extremes in their own party.
Well, again, I don't think finger-pointing is really going to help the discussion. But, if we're going to get a handle on it, I think, too, it's interesting, or, one thing to take into consideration is there are federal laws. There have been a very frustration with the federal government not acting quickly enough, with Congress not being able to enact federal laws, but also a lot of this is up to the states, or there is some discretion with the states. Gun control laws vary from state to state. So, the other thing with this is, as you look at it, is we can look at what those federal laws are, we can look at what the laws are on the books in North Carolina, we can look at what other states are doing and perhaps see what is working, what's effective, and then craft our laws in the most effective way that we can. I'd like to see North Carolina be a leader, be a model in this as we have in so many other things.
Simple. Ban assault weapons. Ban machine guns. Ban effective machine guns, weapons that can kill dozens of people in seconds. They should simply be illegal in our country.
You on board with that, too?
I think we need to take a good hard look at that. I'll be honest with you. I am not a gun owner. I am not a gun person. I don't have enough research or background to know which guns are the most dangerous. I think that what we do know is that there are people and individuals who, when they have guns in their hands, are extremely dangerous people. And I think that we need to focus on that as well.
Real quick, we will move on, I promise. I don't expect there to be any legislation that moves in this building on this issue this year. Would you expect there to be any?
No, more than anything, because we're really getting towards the end of the session. And
are
I just
we?
Don't think that. Well, we,
sorry,
we hope.
That snark is not directed at you.
Yeah, we hope.
But no.
But this is something really good to tee up for the short session, or also a special session, for consideration, when you can really talk about it. What I hope doesn't happen is that something is just quickly moved for the sake of moving something, and then we deal with unintended consequences later.
We just passed $24 billion budgets that way. I mean, come on. They're not going home anytime soon. We could have a series of responsible committee meetings. They could have started this week. There's legislation that's been sitting there for 6 months. Representative Marsha Moore, Representative Pricey Harrison have introduced modest, middle-of-the-road legislation that Republicans are now talking about in Congress. That could have been dealt with months ago, but it could still be dealt with in a couple of committee meetings. It wouldn't even be that controversial if the Republicans would let it go. It's just criminal that we're going to wait another year to do this, if then.
Let's move on to healthcare, major hospitals, and the state treasurer remain at odds over reimbursement rates and increased transparency. Some major providers have balked at Republican Dale Falwell's efforts to change pricing practices. Two deadlines to reach an agreement for the state health plan have come and gone. As of now, several major hospital systems have not opted into the state health plan for 2020. That means that hundreds of thousands of state workers could potentially be considered out of network, driving costs way up for patients. Falwell has adjusted his position on pricing somewhat. However, hospitals, at least publicly, really haven't moved all that much. Do you support Falwell's approach, or is he playing too dangerous of a game here?
He's been sort of a bull in a china shop on this. This isn't just started. I mean, for a long time, Falwell has been taking steps that he claims are about fiscal responsibility and containing costs. You can make a very strong argument that a lot of it is about reducing coverage, getting people out of coverage. There were a series of letters that were sent to state employees in previous years that were confusing, that made them continually have to prove that their children were their children. They were sent via bulk mail in a way that was quite likely that many people missed them. I mean, I think there's good reason to be very suspicious of his motives when it comes to this issue. We have a lot of people whose lives are literally at stake as a result of this right now. It's not something we ought to be playing sort of this hardball political negotiation with. It's something they should have worked out a long time ago.
I don't think there's anything shady about this at all. I think this comes down to a matter of numbers. You've got 700,000 state employees and teachers who are dependent on the state health plan for health coverage for them and their families. That fund is 4% funded. That's it, 4%. And it's going to run out of money if we continue along this path
in
4 years.
Reserve. Sorry to cut you off, just for clarity.
That premise is based on the notion that if everybody retired all at once and we paid everything all at once, that theoretically, in some sense, that, you know, there's billions and billions of dollars of shortfall. The reality is, on an annualized basis, it's in the order of hundreds of millions of dollars that we have had a shortfall. And that could have been easily plugged by the General Assembly if they hadn't implemented billions of dollars in unnecessary tax cuts for the wealthy. And Falwell supported those. So if he had just not had those tax cuts, we could have easily plugged these holes. We wouldn't even be having this discussion.
And that's the pension plan. We're talking about the health plan.
We're talking about the health plan.
Well, what the numbers and the actuarial folks at the state health, at the state treasurer's office, who are authorized and this is their job to take care of this, have said if they don't get lower cost, and part of the problem is they don't know what they're paying. There is no transparency in this at all. And as health care costs continue to go up for all of us, they're also going up for the state health plan. And there's a challenge as to whether or not the state health plan is going to be able to cover all of the claims that the state employees and the teachers have. This is the concern with this. So Falwell's...
You're saying there's a concern. There's a concern.
There's a concern that if we continue to go as we are with the reimbursements made pretty much just whatever the hospitals bill, and the state treasurer has no knowledge of what those are going to be.
Falwell has maintained that is not fiscally prudent, and it could bankrupt
exactly.
the system.
Yes. Okay. That's exactly. Yes.
And there's no doubt that's an issue to be dealt with. It's not a trivial matter. The matter of reimbursement is something to be dealt with, and we need to have some, but, you know, it's gotten into this name-calling thing. It's gotten into this point where Falwell's allies are writing hit pieces about hospital CEOs. We don't need to go down that road. This is something that sane adults, like the state budget, ought to just negotiate, get this solved, get some responsible common ground instead of playing the bull in the china shop role.
I want to just touch on something you said earlier, Rob. When you said you're concerned about Falwell's motives, what I heard, I want you to tell me, are you insinuating that this is a long play for Republicans to kick a whole bunch of people off the state health plan?
Well, we had a great op-ed that was written by a public school teacher from Wake County, actually, that ran on NC Policy Watch last week, in which she explained sort of the history of all the communiques she'd gotten from the state health plan that were very confusing, that were clearly designed to dissuade people from maintaining coverage, to ask them to be more conservative consumers when it came to health care. I mean, it seems to me that there's a rationing sort of motive involved here, that it's not just about getting hospitals to control costs. It's about getting perhaps less generous coverage to people, less widespread coverage to people. And that would be perfectly consistent with sort of the general philosophy that Treasurer Falwell has evinced throughout his political career, which is sort of an anti-government, anti-tax policy, and I think it's playing out in his management of the healthcare system.
I have never known Dale Falwell, particularly since he has become the state treasurer, to do anything except try to do his job well and assume the responsibility that he is entrusted by the General Assembly and the people of North Carolina to do this. He's just trying to shore up the state health plan so that these 700,000 people that are dependent on that plan can depend on it. What we've gotten into, and again, this is another example of finger pointing and accusations and personal accounts that break down any kind of negotiations. I think that's what's happened between the hospitals and the treasurer, to be honest with you. I think there is not a lot of trust between the two parties. And, you know, it's hard to negotiate when you're at that stage in it. You know, one of the things we've proposed at the Locke Foundation, kind of thought about, is if you need to lower cost and you need more transparency, why don't you just ask the hospitals and all the providers to take, I don't know, you know, a 5-10% cut in their reimbursements across the board, rather than it being tied to Medicare reimbursements, which it is now, and make the payments and the charges transparent within the parties that are part of that contract to administer it.
The hospitals have no interest in transparency right now. Can we all agree on that?
Well, I think that's generally true, but if we would expand Medicaid, then the hospitals might be in a better position where so many of them wouldn't be facing bankruptcy. I mean, the reality is that lots of healthcare systems in our state are on the edge right now, and when you come in like a bull and say, all right, we're going to slash your reimbursement rates,
they're increasing the reimbursement rates. The latest offer he's made is 200% of Medicare reimbursements.
Right, but that is relative to current Medicare rates, not relative to the current reimbursement rates, which we don't fully understand what those are.
The bottom line is it's something that it needs to be sanely negotiated, not through press releases and personal attacks. I agree with that.
And in the spirit of finger-pointing and personal attacks, I will just note that it is now the 40th day of the new fiscal year. There is not a state budget. We're not going to have a discussion on this because unless either of you wants to raise your hand and jump in, there's nothing new to discuss. So no new state budget, something we will discuss in the weeks to come. I betcha. Finally, we learned this week that interim UNC President Bill Roper failed to disclose millions of dollars that he received while serving on various corporate boards. Some of those corporations that he was serving were at the same time doing business with the state. Roper previously led the UNC health system. He is a medical doctor. The report from WBTV Television notes that Roper was paid more than $3.5 million across 8 years for his service on a number of boards, which he did not list on a state disclosure form. Not him not doing that could be a misdemeanor if it was an accident, could be a felony if he purposefully did not disclose those things. Should this revelation disqualify Roper from serving as UNC system president permanently?
I don't know that, you know, flat out disqualify him. I think it's something certainly that should be taken under consideration. I mean, these economic interest statements are something pretty serious. People all across the state that serve on boards and commissions in official capacities, elected officials, have to fill them out. They're not that complicated. I mean, I guess the more stuff you own, the more complicated it becomes. You know, I think it's unfortunate that President Roper chose not to do this. I mean, Harry Smith, the president of the Board of Governors, has come out and said he believes that it was completely unintentional, but yet,
He said a couple of different things.
Well, that's true. Yes, and Carolina Journal's been reporting on that, and he told our reporters one thing and then came back and said something else. So there's some questions about that, but, you know, does that disqualify him? I don't know. I think it's certainly something, and I'm certainly not in a position to determine whether or not he is qualified to serve as the president. I think it's something that certainly should be taken into consideration along with a lot of other things.
It's hard to see how this doesn't present a huge political problem for Roper in terms of whether it should disqualify him or not. I mean, a lot of people think Roper's a pretty smart guy and has done some great work, but this is such a huge, a remarkable omission. It's just hard to imagine how someone can. First of all, I would argue that it's sort of hard to imagine and questionable whether people should act, and it's sort of a testament to sort of the elitist economy we live in these days, in which people can literally rake in millions of dollars for serving on boards of directors that their friends put them on there, and then they literally collect millions of dollars for merely serving on a board of directors is, I think, a questionable reality of our modern economy to begin with. But even setting that aside, how you could rake in millions of dollars and not think as a public official. And apparently, 1 year he actually did it. Wasn't in 2017.
He may have actually done
some reporting. So that makes it even more like a total head scratcher. What in the world was this man thinking? It's just it's a very sad development for generally a pretty competent person. And it's hard to me to, I think he had an uphill fight anyway. He's at times indicated he didn't even want the job permanently, although many people think he does. But I think this is a huge political problem going forward for him.
Rob Schofield directs NC Policy Watch. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Enjoy your weekends.
Thank you very much.